Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. For the rest of the afternoon, around the valley will stay partly cloudy. There is a 20% chance for some rain tonight, blowing dust, of course, a possibility as well. And then for tomorrow, mostly sunny skies with a high of 101. Currently, relative humidity is at 27%, and it's 97 degrees at KJZZ. In valley traffic, an accident 51 southbound at Bell. There's also a collision near I-17 northbound and 7th Street. State transportation officials say construction on the South Mountain Freeway will start next month after a federal judge ruled against a coalition that's tried to block the project. But as KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports from the West Valley Bureau, the coalition says it'll seek an injunction while the appeal.
Work on the 22-mile extension of the Loop 202 is scheduled to start where it connects with Interstate 10 in the East Valley. But the coalition opposed to the project says they're appealing to the Ninth Circuit, and they think it will conclude that freeway planners broke federal environmental law. Dustin Krugel is with the Arizona Department of Transportation. He says a, quote, very aggressive schedule will get the project done in about 3 years.
The opponents of this project are certainly entitled to appeal, but Friday's decision was a huge victory for Valley motorists, and we intend to start construction on the project in early September.
Krugel says the design process continues, and officials have not determined when they'll start work in the West Valley. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A federal judge wants Sheriff Joe Arpaio to face criminal charges for disobeying court orders in a racial profiling case. As KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports, the case is now in the hands of federal prosecutors who are deciding whether to take legal action against the six-term sheriff.
In May, federal judge Marie Snow found Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio in civil contempt of court for repeatedly violating court orders. Now the judge has decided Arpaio's disobedience was so severe, he should face criminal contempt charges. Friday, the judge asked the U.S. attorney to prosecute the elected sheriff, plus the chief deputy, a captain, and one of Arpaio's former lawyers. This is all very unusual, says University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris.
It is just not a common thing at all for a court to use the criminal contempt powers, and rarer still for a court to order criminal contempt charges against elected officials.
Harris says this situation is rare, but so are the facts in this case. Judge Snow began overseeing reforms at the sheriff's office 3 years ago after finding Arpaio's deputies discriminated against Latinos in their zealous efforts to crack down on illegal immigration. But the sheriff and his staff didn't follow court orders. They kept making immigration arrests for over a year after the judge forbade it. They withheld evidence. The judge even said they lied to his face.
The court must feel, you know, how else do I get this guy's attention? How else do I get him to start following the court's orders instead of treating them like they're options?
On Friday, federal judge Susan Bolton was assigned to oversee the criminal case against the sheriff. But first, federal prosecutors have to decide if they want to take it on. Arpaio's lawyer, Mel McDonald, says there isn't sufficient evidence against his client to justify it.
We will meet with the U.S. Attorney's Office and try to convince them not to bring a criminal contempt charge.
If federal prosecutors decline the case, Judge Bolton can assign a special prosecutor. The charge could be a misdemeanor or a felony, and the penalty could be prison time. McDonald says if a trial does go forward,
we will ask for a jury and we will litigate it to the bitter end, and I believe we'll win.
On Friday night, Latino community leaders gathered to celebrate the judge's decision to refer Arpaio for criminal contempt. Though attorney Danny Ortega said the moment was bittersweet.
We have to continue to remember the pain that he caused in our community by enforcing the law in a discriminatory manner.
Judge Snow also directed the county on Friday to establish a $500,000 fund to compensate people who were wrongfully detained, some of whom were also deported. Alfredo Gutierrez, a longtime civil rights activist who's also president of the Maricopa Community College Governing Board, said those who oppose the sheriff need to put pressure on federal prosecutors so they take the case. He's still disappointed that 4 years ago, the Justice Department closed a criminal abuse of power investigation against Arpaio.
We will be meeting with the U.S. Attorney. We'll be demonstrating, if that's what it takes. We'll ask for a meeting with Loretta Lynch. We'll ask for a meeting with the president.
Many in the Latino community say justice will be served when Arpaio goes to prison. The immigrant rights group Puente is organizing a demonstration today in front of U.S. Attorney John Leonardo's office. A spokesman for the U.S. attorney said there's no timeline for the office to make a decision. Next week, Arpaio faces three challengers in the Republican primary. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And as you heard, reaction to Friday afternoon's decision by Judge Snow came swiftly, but there's more in the situation that has developed. Members of the community were out in force today to express their feelings and what they think should happen next with Sheriff Arpaio. And KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block is joining me with additional details. Jude, you're just getting back from the U.S. Attorney's Office where there was a rally. What was going on down there?
Yeah, the immigrant rights group Puente organized a rally right outside of the office building in downtown where the U.S. attorney has his office suite. And so they brought this giant balloon that they've been bringing to the court sometimes. It's a balloon of Arpaio in prison stripes and handcuffs. They were chanting, "Arrest Arpaio, not the people." They had speakers, including immigrants whose families had been impacted by Arpaio's worksite raids, who spent time in his jails, who said they want to see Arpaio experience the same kind of, the same thing they experienced when they were in jail. They want to see him go to prison. That was really their message for the U.S. attorney.
And so do you think they got that message across?
Well, as I was leaving about an hour ago, some of these activists, including some immigrants who were personally impacted by Arpaio's policies, went upstairs to try and talk with U.S. Attorney John Leonardo. And there was a heavy law enforcement presence in the building. It was a little bit tense, but when I left, they were negotiating whether his office would send out a representative to talk to one representative of the activists.
Jude, let's back up briefly. Explain what Judge Snow said in his order about why this merited criminal contempt of court. As we know, he's already held the sheriff in civil contempt of court. Why was this next step needed?
Right. And I mean, there were civil remedies, and those are starting to come out. This was from the order in May, where the judge first found the sheriff had willfully violated orders, and he's ordered changes to the Internal Affairs Department. He's ordered the county to set aside $500,000 to compensate people who were wrongfully detained by sheriff's deputies. And but the judge points out in this ruling that doesn't personally impact the sheriff. That's coming out of county taxpayer money, and that the sheriff has actually politically profited in some ways by defying the judge, that he continued to campaign on anti-immigration immigration enforcement policies in 2012, even after the judge had ordered him to stop making immigration arrests. So the judge points all that out, and he even points out that, you know, even after the judge had ordered a civil contempt hearing in 2015, there were more incidents where the sheriff and his staff did not hand over evidence, did not disclose things to the court, and made misstatements on the stand. So he brings all of that together as part of his justification for ordering this criminal referral, and basically says, "This is a last resort. Nothing I've done so far has gotten these guys to comply," is basically his message.
And Jude, very briefly, where does that fit in for those who are saying, "Oh, Judge Snow made this personal"? How does his action not reflect that?
Well, the judge this is going to another judge to oversee. It's already been assigned to Susan Bolton. The U.S. attorney can decline to bring charges. Then it'll be up to the new judge to assign an independent prosecutor, but only if that new judge sees fit. So there are some checks and balances here.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block with the latest on the MCSO. Jude, thanks as always.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Phil Latzman.
And Steve, new voter registration numbers are out for Arizona, and they show about 47,000 new voters signed up for this month's primary election.
They also show Republicans outnumbering independents for the first time in nearly 3 years. Of the just over 3.4 million voters in the state, about 35% are registered Republicans, 30% Democrats, 34% are unaffiliated. Libertarians and Green Party members make up less than 1%.
And joining us now is Arizona Secretary of State Michelle Reagan, who's had a chance to look at these figures. And you've called them interesting. How so, and what sticks out to you?
Well, first of all, we're really happy to see that voter registration went up 47,000 new voters since the last time we compiled the numbers from all 15 counties. And in addition, then to see that more people are, which is a reverse of some of the trends that we've seen, more people are now choosing to register within a party instead of registering as independent. That was something different than we had seen in the last couple of numbers that had come out over the last couple, about 18 months. So that is interesting to see that people are choosing to register within parties.
Now, why is that? You cited, you think the reason for that is because people were not allowed to vote as independents in the primary, and they just sort of stayed that way through this primary.
Yeah, that could be that we had the presidential preference election in March, and that, of course, is the one election every 4 years where people are not, independents are not able to vote unless they're registered within a party. So we think that a lot of people may have registered within a party and then chosen to stay within a party versus switching back to independent. You know, it gets a little confusing for independent voters, especially because they, of course, are able to vote mm-hmm. in the August primaries, the state primary. But then when they hear the word primary, they, you know, sometimes get a little nervous. Is this one I can vote in or not? This, of course, we like to remind people, the August 30th primary, independents are able to vote in this primary. They are encouraged and welcomed to vote in this primary.
I know there's been a lot of attention on making sure that there are enough voting locations set up in some of the large counties, of course, Maricopa being a part of that after what happened in March. Are you confident from the state's perspective that voting will go smoothly for this primary and for the general election in November?
Oh, well, we sure feel a lot better about it. Maricopa County has decided to have 700 plus polling centers or polling locations, which is phenomenal. And we go back to what's called precinct-based polling. And this is very important. This is where voters go to their individual neighborhood polling places. So the places that they've always been going to for prior elections, prior to the May and March elections. So the neighborhood polling centers that they've always walked to and always gone to is what we're going to have again this time.
So you think we've put all these issues behind us?
We are working overtime to make sure that anything that we saw arise in past elections that could be remedied, we are trying to make sure the counties are remedying them.
Arizona Secretary of State Michelle Reagan, thank you.
Thank you.
Nearly a year and a half ago, Governor Doug Ducey put out the call asking the Arizona Board of Education to review the state's math and English standards and suggest any necessary changes. On Friday, the conclusions reached by the Standards Development Committee were officially made public, and earlier today, the details were discussed. Nora Reyes, Vice Provost at Mesa Community College's Red Mountain campus, is a member of the Standards Development Committee, and she joins me. Nora, how common is it and how important is it for standards to be reassessed periodically?
Oh, absolutely. We have to be responsive to the current realities that we are facing. So the Common Core State Standards that arose years ago, we've been revisiting them. These are a big new national initiative that has swept the nation. However, it's something that is and should be done regularly across the nation, across globally, in fact, because we have to make sure that our educational systems are responsive to the needs of our society, local and global. And that actually came up at our committee meeting on Friday afternoon. where this is not something that is just a static process. It has to be a dynamic process, and we do need to continue revisiting these standards as teachers begin to implement them, as new things come up that need to be addressed, and a constant revisiting to make sure that they are aligned with our realities and what we envision for the future.
And do those realities include sort of generally making Arizona more competitive in that when Arizona students graduate from high school, whether they move on to community college or universities or a vocational school, that they're more prepared? How much of it just comes down to that concrete statement, being more prepared?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's what we all strive for. Any educational institution that is preparing students wants to make sure that their graduates are going to be successful in whatever area they choose to go, whether it's high school students going on to college or high school students going out into the workforce. We want to make sure that they are successful in whatever role we can play in that success. We need to be prepared to do the best we can to prepare them for that success.
Anything that stands out to you that feels like a pretty dramatic step?
I think the intent behind this additional revision and reviewing of the standards has been on both rigor and clarity. So many have been concerned about the level of rigor. We want to make sure that we are competitive, so the standards need to be rigorous, but they also need to be clear so that both educators and parents or family members who are supporting their kids at home can provide the necessary supports.
Did you get any special insight that you didn't already know from serving on this committee and looking at standards? Did it give you any more insight, even as someone who already knew a lot about Arizona's education system?
I think what strikes me most about this entire process is both the public's engagement and their desire to make sure that they can do what they can to support our students, our youth actually going into the as they prepare to go into the workforce or into higher education.
Nora Reyes is Vice Provost at Mesa Community College's Red Mountain campus. We've been talking about proposed revisions of Arizona's education standards. KJZZ is licensed to the Maricopa Community College District. A child with severe medical problems can be overwhelming to care for. They're often deemed medically fragile and need constant intensive care at home. But what if that's not affordable or not possible? In Mesa, four medical group homes known as the Bogdan House have taken in these children. Half are from faraway Indian reservations where medical facilities, equipment, and specialists are harder to come by. From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
When Betsy Savino walks in the front door of the group home, a toddler rolls out her IV pole to greet her. She fake cries until Savino picks her up.
You give me a kiss? I'm going to give you a kiss on those fat little cheeks. Mm-hmm.
2-year-old Lisa Teller, who is Navajo, can't eat food like most toddlers. She was born with a rare digestive disorder. Her IV is her nutrition and medicine line, and it's attached directly to her bloodstream. Lisa is among 24 children at the Bogdan House. The kids all have intensive care needs, ranging from constant ventilation to oxygen to tracheostomy care.
You know, we didn't have the technology in the past to keep kids alive. So parents would just take them home and do the best they could, and they'd live as long as they could live, or they'd put them in an institution, and that would be that.
Savino says some kids arrive at the Bogdan House as premature infants.
With modern technology, particularly preemies are being kept alive with home ventilators, so there's just more and more and more of them.
That means the Bogdan House often has a wait list. Savino says a lot of parents won't or can't deal with complex medical needs or live too far from medical care, or sometimes the kids are removed from parents for neglect. There are two other long-term care facilities in Phoenix that serve children. They're staffed with respiratory therapists, doctors, and pharmacies. The Bogdan House gets by with far less.
We do it by ourselves without a respiratory therapist. And we fill prescriptions at an outside pharmacy. So unfortunately, I'm a nurse practitioner, so I can pinch hit a lot of the time with the kids and solve problems so we don't have to be going to the emergency room all the time.
You want to talk? You guys say hi.
You're not going to do it.
Little Lisa Teller is waiting for a bowel and liver transplant.
I have a bag packed, ready to go. She has a bag packed, ready to go. And they said they'll just call and say, come to XYZ airport by such and such a time. And they have a transport plane, I guess, that flies us there.
Lisa's family lives on the Navajo Nation 200 miles away.
We missed everything.
Latanya Dixon is Lisa's mom.
Her first laugh, her first Christmas, her first Thanksgiving, you know, her first tooth, her first crawl. You know, that's really heartbreaking to me.
We spoke earlier this year outside her home in Bird Springs. They're still trying to get running water so Lisa can eventually come home.
You know, I just wanted to be out there with her every day. Had no choice but just to leave her in the medical home and have them take care of her, in which they've done a really good job.
Dixon, her husband, and four other kids will pile in their truck to make the long drive down to the Bogdan house once or twice a month.
But when we first go to see her, she doesn't recognize us. We would go to try to touch her hand or, you know, try to talk to her, and she'll just look at us and look at one of the nurses that are on duty and like start to cry. But you know, after the kids start to throw her toys around and make her laugh, then she gets used to us.
But the family can't always afford the gas money. The Bogdan house often winds up paying for families to come see their kids, especially if the child is near death. Betsy Savino says she and her husband have paid for several funerals. Recently, they set up a nonprofit charity to help offset some of not only the child's costs, but the family's. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Don't let some of our monsoon-related rains fool you. The dramatic long-running drought in Arizona and the Southwest continues, and that makes short- and long-term water planning even more vital. That's what led the Arizona Department of Water Resources and the Central Arizona Project to hold a meeting today about the Colorado River, its conditions, and contingency planning in case of a water shortage. Tom Bishotsky, the director of the Department of Water Resources, joins me. And Tom, what was at the core of today's discussion?
Risks to Lake Mead that really have been created because of the long-term 17-year drought, and that we are creating an overlay, additional actions to be taken on top of the shortage guidelines that are in place for Lake Mead so that we can reduce the probabilities that Lake Mead falls to unhealthy levels.
So, Tom, even with preparation that Arizona has been making, how daunting does the horizon look at this point? What are some things that could make it so Arizona wouldn't have to take some of these steps? How close are we to having to take some of these contingency steps?
So we have the ability to conserve additional volumes of water in Lake Mead, as we've been doing for the last several years. Those volumes have helped us avoid having the first shortage trigger. We can do some more of that. But if those best efforts fail, we need to have this contingency plan as a backstop to make sure that if Mother Nature doesn't cooperate with us and turn the drought around, we again will have more robust plans in place, that is, taking larger mandatory shortages to protect the lake. So that is a daunting task because, again, one of the things we are trying to do is to get California for the first time to agree to take less than its Colorado River allocation, because based on law back to 1968, they have a priority over Arizona in terms of the Central Arizona Project use within our state. And under that law, all of the Central Arizona Project water would have to dry up before California takes any reduction in its use.
What incentive does California have to play nice then, in essence?
So the incentive is California, as well as Arizona and Nevada, have had the option since 2007 to conserve water, store it in Lake Mead in your name, so to speak, and take that water out at some point in time after you had originally stored it. The drought in California that they are just maybe starting to get out of, we hope, during that drought in California, they took substantial quantities of water out of Lake Mead that they had conserved. through another specific piece of law and policy, California can't take out that specifically conserved water when Arizona is in a shortage. And so part of what we are negotiating with them is to give them more flexibility to be able to do that in return for them voluntarily taking shortages.
How much does Mother Nature have to cooperate for this contingency plan not to have to come into place?
We don't have the contingency plan completed yet. Mm-hmm. There are many other steps. But assuming that it did get completely done, we would need a monster year of snow on the Colorado River watershed, probably similar to 2011 when Lake Powell sent 11 million acre feet of water to Lake Mead, and the normal is a little over 8 million acre feet. We need that kind of a year to forestall those shortages that we're talking about.
Tom Bishotsky is Arizona Department of Water Resources Director. Tom, thank you.
All right, thank you.
It's Monday, so let's celebrate the working life. We're talking to the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. Maybe you need a backyard makeover or your landlord is trying to spruce up the place. The noise begins, and a few weeks go by, and the yard is transformed into a tidy, lush oasis. Today we step into a day on the job doing landscape construction.
My name is Kent with Blooming Desert, and I'm project manager, and we're in North Scottsdale. Today we are unloading plants, trees, working on pavers, installing an alumawood structure, and preparing for irrigation. We've designed a front yard, backyard, and a pool. We're creating outdoor living spaces. This job on normal industry standard would probably be a 4-week job that we're trying to do in about 7 days. Summer is, you gotta love it to do it. We get in there early as we can. It's residential. You don't want to wake up the whole neighborhood. We would love to start with headlamps on and start at 3 in the morning. However, we do start typically 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. Try to get out of the heat after 8 or 9 hours. Jackhammers we'll use for digging footings when our machines can't do it. We'll use it for digging plant holes, tree holes. It's faster and easier than a pick. That wears you out. This machine does all the digging, does it really fast.
Buenos dias.
Good morning.
What are we doing today?
Dropping off the garden and the fire glass.
So inside the fire pit, we're putting glass. Very contemporary feel to it. I come out every morning, I'm looking at elevations, measurements, making sure everything's going into plan. So we have a scaled drawing, I'm making sure that it's been laid out correctly, that the slopes are correct for drainage purposes. Put a lot of work into planning. So when everything comes together, the plan has been executed, that gives me great joy.
That's Kent McCracken landscaping a home in North Scottsdale. Good afternoon in KJZZ News at 2:37. A new study finds Arizona is among the best states for community colleges. The personal finance website WalletHub ranks Arizona 16th overall and the Cochise County College District as the 4th best in the nation. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports.
When it comes to the highest return on educational investment, Cochise County ties for the top spot, largely due to education and career outcomes, which include graduation rates and starting salaries. WalletHub looked at more than 800 schools and compared metrics like tuition and fees, retention rates, and student loan default rates. Other Arizona colleges that rank in the top 100 include Mojave Community College, Tohono O'odham Community, Scottsdale Community, and Paradise Valley Community. Rio Salado College in Tempe had the lowest cost per student and one of the lowest graduation rates. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
KJZZ is licensed to the Maricopa Community College District. The area around Tempe Town Lake is about to become more populated. A development team has been selected to develop the city's biomedical and technology campus. Donna Kennedy with the City of Tempe says with the final team assembled, they hope to start building soon. She says many businesses have expressed high demand for these spaces due to its proximity to Arizona State University.
There's not a lot of research labs, wet labs and dry labs, in close proximity to ASU's biodesign. So we realized, after having been approached by various companies, given the fact that they like the workforce coming out of ASU as far as their research, and they wanted to capture on that.
The proposed 1-million-square-foot campus would sit on the southwest side of Tempe Town Lake. Kennedy says the city hopes to have the first phase of construction completed by 2018. As homeowners and firefighters in California and across the Southwest are learning, preparing for a natural disaster is a lot more than stocking up on water and supplies. Training matters here. And if you live in an earthquake-prone area, in grade school you probably had those drop, cover, and hold drills. The question is, though, can you test an entire city? It turns out you can, and that's exactly what they did in Portland, Oregon. The west coast of the United States is overdue for a massive earthquake. Experts say it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So to get ready for this inevitable disaster, this summer officials across the Pacific Northwest simulated their response with dozens of cities, state, and federal agencies all mobilizing their emergency teams. It was the largest event of its kind. Cassandra Profita from Oregon Public Broadcasting reports on what happened when a simulated earthquake disaster hit Portland.
All right, let's get victim over here.
A firefighter and a National Guardsman are checking for bodies in a pile of crumpled cars at the base of a tower. They pull a dummy out of one of the cars, one of the few survivors of the simulated earthquake emergency. They strap the dummy onto a backboard and hook it onto a set of ropes hanging from the tower.
Ready to hoist victim?
Stand by.
The scene is designed to mimic one of many disastrous situations that would follow a major quake. Matthew Silva is overseeing the operation for the Portland Fire Department.
Basically, we have an overpass that's crashed down. We've got three vehicles down there, multiple victims that are trapped at the bottom of this ravine, at the bottom of the overpass.
To get to the pileup, the first responders had to rappel down from the tower. Now, they need to hoist the patients back up to safety.
Patient ready? Patient ready. Go ahead. Go ahead.
So I'll go ahead and get started as people file in.
Across town, a dozen city officials gather inside a conference room at Portland's Emergency Coordination Center.
So the people that should be here, we have the unified command here.
They're wearing colored vests that correspond to their roles in responding to the biggest emergency Portland may ever see.
Yes. Is everybody here? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, can we have them go ahead and introduce themselves?
Rich Denhouse, fire.
Okay. David Peters, water.
Steve Townsend, transportation.
Their job is to review the situation and direct the next phase of the simulated emergency response. But first, a headcount.
So do we have we have finances here also, correct? What is our yellow-vested friend? What are
logistics.
You? Your logistics?
Yep.
Is there finance in here?
No, that's a green vest.
Yes, are they not? Okay.
Right off the bat, Planning Chief Marty Shaw notes they're missing a green-vested member of the finance team, and the electronic whiteboard isn't working. But that's the least of their worries. He turns to Police Lieutenant Ashton Brewer for a situation report.
The incident summary, I'm not going to read all of this. We'll just review 9.0 Cascadia subduction zone earthquake this morning at 0800. Aerial reports show widespread damages across the region. Active fires, hazardous materials, and mass casualty events have been reported throughout the city. Streets and roadways are inaccessible in most areas due to downed power lines, trees, road signs, abandoned and damaged vehicles, and building debris.
Now remember, this is only a drill, but the situation is bleak. Almost all the bridges over the Willamette River are down, along with the phone lines, water, and power. Hundreds of buildings have collapsed, and many streets and sidewalks are buried under several feet of debris. Emergency responders can't get to many of the worst hit areas, and the aftershocks continue to cause additional damage.
I think that pretty much wraps up the city's status. Chief, want to go from there?
To make matters worse, the group finds they don't even know how many city staffers are available to respond to all the emergencies. They add a new objective to their list: identify all available city personnel and equipment in the next 12 hours. After the exercise wrapped up, officials reviewed what they learned.
Many people who are the most trained responders likely will not be able to get to work and get to the emergency coordination center.
Carmen Merlot is the director of the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. She says one of the big lessons is that the city will need a lot more volunteers.
Well, one of the things we have to do is to train a larger number of people to make sure we have some bench depth. We really can't rely on a very small cadre of people being exceptionally prepared.
The city has a vision for how everyday people can sub in for first responders when the big one hits.
Let's see if we can get this one to work. Beep.
At an upscale retirement home, volunteer program developer Ernie Jones is training new recruits to set up and operate neighborhood emergency tents.
So it's working. And so it's got an on-off volume knob. That's that. And it's got the channels. Channel 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
He's holding a UHF radio, which could be their only line of emergency communication when the phones go down. Portland officials have hidden dozens of these radios, along with other essential supplies, in emergency equipment caches all over the city. Jones says they're counting on volunteers to check on their neighbors and use these supplies when the time comes.
Yeah, it's really important. We know from history that 94 to 98% of people who are helped, saved, or rescued after a disaster are helped, saved, or rescued by their neighbors, not by anybody else, not by firefighters, police, or other professional first responders. And that's not because the police and firefighters and others don't want to help. It's because there's not enough of them.
Jones worked for FEMA during 55 disasters across the U.S. He trains volunteers to be ready for a harsh reality.
You know, we've got 30 or 31 fire stations in Portland, and the firefighters will tell you quite bluntly, big calamity happens. If they can get their fire trucks out of the station, what they're going to be doing is driving down the street in their, what they call their fire management area, the area they're responsible for, and they are going to be seeing where the greatest need is, and that's going to mean passing people on the street, waving, saying, I need help.
Carmen Merlot says the city's neighborhood volunteer program got a boost from the Pulitzer Prize-winning article, The Really Big One, in The New Yorker last year.
The interest has really just grown exponentially, and we now have, you know, over a 1,400-person wait list for these classes.
She says the city now has about 1,000 active volunteers, but it needs 10 times that amount to prepare the city's neighborhoods for the worst-case scenario.
That's Oregon Public Broadcasting's Cassandra Perfita from our partners at The Takeaway. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has moved to protect nearly 36,000 acres in Arizona as critical habitat for two types of cacti, the Acuna and Ficus in plains. They've been disappearing because of drought, extreme temperatures, and other factors. Environmental activists have cheered the decision. One of them is Michael Robinson of the Center for Biological Diversity, and he joins me. Michael, why was this step necessary, and why are these cacti significant?
These species, you know, we don't know if they have any, you know, particular economic value to humanity, but for those of us who find the unique deserts of Arizona a joy and replenish our spirit, it's good to know that, these creatures, these plants still survive out there. They are, you know, occasionally food sources for other animals, but I think their survival is testament to the beauty in nature that we should safeguard, and that is now disappearing with many different plants and animals going extinct.
Are modifications that would help the situation be reversed, how controversial are those? Is this federal action something that can really make a huge difference in and of itself?
Well, it will make a difference. A critical habitat for endangered plants and animals has been shown in peer-reviewed studies to be tightly associated with reversing declines and starting a species towards recovery, and that certainly can only help here because these cacti are facing several threats. They're facing the threat of being run over. The Acuna cactus in southern Arizona is subject to being run over by border protection activities, driving in the desert and simply being run over. Up north, there's also threats from off-road vehicles and from livestock grazing. Livestock grazing threatens both the Acuna cactus in the south and the Ficus in plains cactus in northern Arizona. So all of those threats will be addressed through this critical habitat designation under the Endangered Species Act, and that's tremendously important.
When we're talking about the nearly 36,000 acres, are we talking about private lands? Are these publicly owned lands? What's the involvement there? And does that complicate thing, or has that complicated things in designated critical habitat?
Most of the land that was protected is public land. Most of it is Bureau of Land Management land, which, of course, that's the agency that oversees much of our publicly owned deserts. There's also Oregon Pipe Cactus National Park has several thousand acres. And there's Forest Service lands, there's state lands, and there are private lands. So it's a mix, but the vast majority is public lands.
How often are those reviewed? Once something is designated as critical habitat, is that something that is safe for a certain number of years? Can people come back and want, if there's a different administration, can they decide against it? How does that work with the various agencies?
It is designated until the Fish and Wildlife Service might at some point go through a rulemaking process to change the designation, whether eliminating it or changing the boundaries, or we hope eventually that the Fish and Wildlife Service will find that there's been, you know, that management and protection has been successful and both of these cacti are recovered and can be taken off of the endangered species list. But frankly, that's going to take many decades before we see that happy circumstance, and I'm being optimistic. But that is, it is something that should survive the political shifts one way or another. It's under a law that's been in place since 1973, the Endangered Species Act. The law provides these authorities and the protection should be in place until there's reason to change it.
Michael Robinson is a conservation advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity. For some of us, fingernail art is a foreign concept. We're happy when we don't have jagged nails with tiny bits of dirt underneath them. But Jimmy Nguyen of Stash House in Phoenix is doing intricate art on that tiny canvas. He isn't just using dramatic colors, he's taking traditional wall art and reducing it to fingernail size. And he doesn't put limits on the process. If a client makes a request for a nail design, Nguyen tries his best to accommodate. Nguyen is part of the New Times list of 100 creatives, and he joins me now. Jimmy, how does this process get started for you and the customer?
I usually ask clientels to come in with an idea, because I can put anything on a nail. It's hard for me to freestyle. I don't have a specific style. I can do so many, so I can't just like sit down and jot something down. So say they bring in a picture and I study it and see if I can downsize the scale of it and just put it on a nail. I use just regular acrylic paints. I don't use anything extravagant. It's pretty simple.
So someone gives you an idea, or they bring you a photo, painting, whatever it may be, some visual thing, maybe it's on their phone, and they want you to make it look like this. Are you getting out some paper? Are you getting out something?
No, it's just...
You're going right to the nail.
Right to the nail.
Wow.
I don't know how I do it, honestly. My girlfriend all the time, like, I don't understand. I don't either, honestly. Well, I just go for it.
So how did this first develop as an interest of yours, though? Did you start off in a different sort of art?
I've always been interested into the art. I always paint and draw when I was younger. But, you know, after high school, I was actually a mason before I did nails. So the economy fell, and my aunt contacted me saying if I wanted to help her out, and she'll help me out, get my license. I'm like, oh, you know, all right, it's fine. So I went out there, and I stayed for a year and a half, and I just stuck with it ever since.
So how long does the process take? And are they sitting there patiently, and you're having this chat with them? Are you able to chat with them as you're actually doing the art?
Yeah. We have music. I talk. I don't lose focus. We're
talking about really detailed art here. I mean, this is not like someone just sort of, oh, here's a glob of whatever, and this looks like true art. And again, I mean, I'm looking at my own fingernail, looking at the size of how small this thing is. Jimmy, there's got to be something else going on as far as how you visualize things. But did it manifest itself in any other form? You mentioned being a mason, but did it manifest itself? Were you a painter ever? Were you ever a tattoo artist? Anything like that?
I just doodled on paper ever since I was younger. And a client came in one day about 5 years ago, hey, can you do this? I was like, you know, I think I can. So I did it, and it worked out. So she would come back every 2 weeks and let me experiment, and it worked out.
Mm-hmm. So are there a couple that really you felt especially great about? I'm sure you feel good about a lot of them. But
a few of my friends are local artists here. I have a couple other works at my house on the wall, and it just, I still look at to this day, just astonished, you know, it's crazy. I like taking other people's artwork and putting it on a canvas, like a small canvas, and I would meet up with them. They're like, oh my gosh, you're amazing, man. I'm like, no, I mean, like, I'm honored to be doing your piece of artwork. And they just tell me, like, I don't know, I wouldn't be able to do it in that small of a scale.
Has there been one that you've tried and you weren't satisfied with it? Is there one that was almost like too much for you to try?
I mean, I had this one client. She goes, hey, I just want to know if you can draw Nick Carter on my nails. I was like, what? I was like, wait, I need to know the story behind this. She goes, no, I'm going to see Nick Carter in Tucson, and I'm going to be in VIP, and I want him to be like, oh my gosh, I'm on your nails. I'm like, I can attempt it, but I'm not really good at portraits. But, I mean, she ended up loving it. It was a little hard. I had a few tries. It was a lot of errors.
So have you ever done your own nails?
No, never.
Okay.
Because I let people practice.
Oh, do you? Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's weird, but, you know, you have to learn like that. So I let one of the girls practice, and I had fake nails on three of my left hand, and I had totally forgot about them, and I went to dinner, and I went up to reach for something. I'm like, oh, my gosh. I had a full set on my hand, you know, so, yeah, I've done them before.
Fingernail artist Jimmy Nguyen of Phoenix, one of the New Times 100 creatives, will be checking in with other creatives on future editions of the show.
Monday, can't trust that day. Monday, sometimes it just turns out that way.
Hey guys.
What's up, G?
Wanna go to Tchotchke's? Get some coffee?
Oh, it's a little early.
I gotta get out of here. I think I'm gonna lose it.
Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
So it's Monday, the day of the week that is usually accompanied by pessimism and gloom. Most people look forward to Fridays or Saturdays, but Mondays don't get that luxury. But there are different perspectives on what Mondays really mean. And today I'm joined by former newspaper man and now owner of Scutari and Sizzlack, Chip Scutari. Chip, what do you think of Mondays?
I believe, and this is the straight talk for me, Mondays are an excellent barometer, an excellent gauge for where you are, your lot in life. And by that I mean there were times when I was in high school where I'd wake up on a Monday morning and say, oh crap, like I really don't want to go through 5 days of school. Right. There were times during my college years in the summer I worked for my county's bridge department, and it was awful work, painting, welding in the hot sun. You'd count the hours, and I would dread getting up on Monday morning. But now that a lot of it probably has to do with my lovely and talented wife, Shannon, my three kids, and I own a business where my business partner and I get to work with a ton of different clients who we like. So I really look forward to work now. It's no joke.
Yeah.
Like, I get up Monday mornings, you know, go for my morning walk, and I'm ready to hit it.
Let's say, though, that Monday for some reason doesn't start out as well as you planned it to, or a meeting doesn't go as well. What do you do to make sure that the rest of the week no longer sort of takes you on that path that it would have in high school? Like, how are you able to twist, like, if a Monday's not going well, but before Monday's over, are you able to flip it?
So I know this is going to be a shocker, but I used to be very immature, which many people would say I still am immature. But when you're immature and you're a teenager or even in college, it's all about you. Nowadays, owning a small business, my wife owns a small business. We have three amazing but high-functioning kids. So you don't really have the luxury of, you know, pouting the rest of the week. I have to worry about what my other clients are going to think. I have to worry about, hey, did my kids get all their homework done? All these various things. I serve on some boards now. So there's always something to take your mind off of it. And that's why I like staying busy, you know, having fun, but also staying busy. So you just don't, when you're in high school, you can, you know, say this teacher's a jerk, you know, for 3 days or 4 days or whatever, or that kid's a, you know, a bully, and you could kind of just belabor the point for almost forever. When you get older, and especially when you have children, you got to move on pretty fast. So you got to compartmentalize.
So any other things that you associate with Mondays? You and I are both big sports fans. Of course, Monday Night Football, people get up for that. When I was a kid, there was Monday Night Baseball.
My beloved Providence College Friars.
Nice shirt,
I am
by the
a
way.
Huge college basketball fan. So someday, some year, my Friars are going to cut down the nets and be champions. And Steve, as you know, that will happen in the Final Four, and it would be a Monday night. So for me, I am dreaming of that Monday night when we cut down the nets, and I will be there somehow, in some way. So that Monday nights, when that happens, I'll never forget it.
Chip Scutari, Scutari and Sizlak, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.